towel, one that his brother didn't share. I tried, again and again, to steer the conversation back to our demands. We wanted Cuba to expand its nascent private sector. We wanted Cuba to reform its economy, to allow foreign businesses to hire Cubans directly, and to show more restraint in its treatment of protesters. I began to enjoy playing this part, friendly but persistent. "You know," Raoul said to me, "a thought has occurred to me that I have never shared. The Americans like to give people candy." He looked around the room, finding nodding agreement on his side. "They like to give people candy for doing whatever they want in Latin America. But Cuba is not interested in candy." After more than 2 hours of this, Raoul announced he would send me a copy of his own biography. "It's by a Russian," he said. "It's good, but it also shows my flaws." "None of us is innocent," I said, and he laughed. I went through some of the remaining issues for our trip, including Obama's planned meeting with dissidents. "Obama is welcome to meet whoever he wants in Cuba," he said, waving his hand in front of him. "Obama is welcome in Cuba." As we neared the 3 hour mark, we wound down the meeting. "It is hard for us," he said, "being your closest neighbor." I corrected him. The Mexicans were our closest neighbor, and they liked to say of themselves, "So close to America, so far from God." He laughed, but in turn corrected me. "Look," he said, pointing down at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base on the map in front of us. "We are your closest neighbor." As Air Force One began its descent into Havana, Obama knelt next to me on the couch, peering out the windows. I was nervous about everything, including some rain that had begun to fall, as if any blemish on the trip would be a personal failure. This felt like the capstone of my 8 years in government. I wanted everything to go perfectly. As the outskirts of Havana came into view, thatched houses and corrugated shacks, Obama said, "That doesn't look like a threat to our national security to me." By the time we touched down in Cuba, we'd announced the farthest-reaching changes in U.S. policy that the law would allow, enabling Americans to travel there for people-to-people engagement and authorizing more financial transactions in Cuba. We'd initiated direct mail service between the United States and Cuba for the first time in decades, with Obama himself responding to a letter from an elderly Cuban woman who had written to the White House. We'd arranged for a Major League Baseball exhibition game to be played during our visit, between the Tampa Bay Rays and the Cuban national team. We'd reached a slew of agreements to get U.S. businesses in the door in Cuba. We'd even had Obama tape a segment with a Cuban comedian named Luis Silva, whose character Panfilo featured on one of the most popular shows in Cuba. As the trip approached, it had become clear that for all our focus on using the trip to maximize changes in policies, the symbolism and story of Obama's visit were going to matter more. I had taken a trip down to Miami to do a series of meetings with leaders in the Cuban-American community. It spoke to the raw feelings of some Cuban exiles that when I exited my commercial flight, I had a sizable police escort waiting for me that followed me throughout the day. In Miami, history was a present thing, and there were people who saw any rapprochement with the Castro government as an act of betrayal. But over the course of the day, I heard a different message. To younger Cuban Americans, Obama's policy was long overdue. The children and grandchildren of exiles didn't carry the same baggage, didn't see the future of Cuba as a competition between Castros and exiles. Some of the old hardliners were changing too. Carlos Gutierrez, who had been George W. Bush's Commerce Secretary, had been transformed from a hardliner into an enthusiastic proponent of engagement. "I just got tired of using the same talking points," he told me. What I heard in Miami, though, was a single message. The most important element of the trip was the speech Obama would give in Havana. Cuban Americans wanted to hear him make the case for democracy, for openness, and to include them in whatever story he told about Cuba. More than any other diaspora community I'd engaged with, Cuban Americans saw themselves as a people in exile. I asked them to share stories and cultural touchstones that would be meaningful for Obama to talk about, and for days afterward my inbox was filled with stories. People whose parents had put them alone on planes to America. People who had been separated from family for decades. People who opposed the government in Havana, but clung to their connections with Cuba. Cuba also seemed to attract a unique assortment of personalities that represented powerful threads from America's own story. Ernest Hemingway had lived there for more than 20 years, and his grandsons reached out to me before our trip. José Andrés, the prominent Spanish-American chef, came with us as he had supported Cuba's self-employed cooks. Jimmy Buffett made plans to play a concert. Jackie Robinson had played baseball in Havana, and we were joined on Air Force One by his daughter and 93-year-old widow, Rachel. It felt as if we were traveling to Havana with a cast of American underdogs and overachievers. Cuban exiles and the offspring of cultural icons, baseball players and singers, civil rights heroes, and of course, an African-American first family. The delegation itself spoke for America. As we rode in from the airport, the ambivalence of the Cuban government was on display. The government had apparently warned people not to line the route of the motorcade to avoid too enthusiastic a greeting for an American president, but they had also repaired and refurbished the streets we drove on. As we passed cement block apartment complexes, I saw clusters of faces pressed against the rain-swept windows, peering out at something they'd never expected to see. The rain built to a downpour as we pulled into Old Havana. Obama went into the Catholic Cathedral and was greeted by Cardinal Ortega, the man who had carried the Pope's personal message to the White House a year before. "I delayed my retirement for this," Ortega said, clutching Obama's hand in greeting. As we walked through the secured streets, people clustered in the windows of shops, smiling and waving, some holding miniature American flags. The next morning, Alejandro was a mix of nerves and confidence. We met in the same government building where I'd spent dozens of hours over the past year, but this time I was traveling with 1,000 Americans. Staffers, security personnel, Cuban Americans, athletes, journalists, and assorted celebrities. Still, I had the feeling we'd be negotiating every aspect of the trip until the moment our plane took off. Sensing my own mix of fatigue and annoyance at having to meet so early, Alejandro declared that he had good news. They had agreed to our two remaining asks, that Obama and Castro do a press conference after their meeting, and that Obama's speech be broadcast, uncensored, to the Cuban people. Neither thing had ever happened before in Cuba. On the motorcade over to the Plaza de la Revolución, it seemed that the Cuban government had either relaxed its restrictions or lost some degree of control as huge crowds greeted the motorcade. After a lengthy meeting with Raúl, the press conference was a circus-like atmosphere. The Cuban journalists, all employees of state-run media, seemed astonished to see their own leader taking questions. Jim Acosta, the same reporter who had asked Obama why he didn't get the bastards, stood up and said, "My father is Cuban. He left for the United States when he was young. Do you see a new and democratic direction for your country? And why do you have Cuban political prisoners?" When it was his turn to answer, Castro looked momentarily confused. His grandson came over and whispered something in his ear. "Give me the list of political prisoners, and I will release them immediately," he then thundered. "Just mention a list. What political prisoners? Give me a name or names." It was, in a way, great theater, the Cuban president forced to answer for his repressive policies, but I knew we were pushing the Cuban system hard, and that there would inevitably be blowback. This was the tension in our policy. The imperative back home was to push the Cubans on human rights, but that could backfire. We got 53 political prisoners out through quiet talks, not through denunciations. Pushing them publicly was not always the best way to get results. After the press conference ended, the Cuban reporters all applauded. Castro shook hands with Obama and then tried to raise their hands together in triumph. Obama, not wanting to have that image plastered on front pages all over the world, let his hand dangle limply in Castro's. It seemed an apt metaphor for our approach, engaging without embracing. That night, I went to the house where the Obamas were staying. The Obama family was hanging out in the living room while he pulled me aside to review the speech. He'd barely edited it, deferring to me. "Do we have enough in here for the Cuban Americans?" he asked. "I think I've talked to just about every Cuban in the United States," I joked. "Well, maybe punch up the point on reconciliation. People are people. Cubans are Cubans. Give it some lift." I went back to the quiet of my empty hotel room. I'd put everything I had learned about Cuba over the last 3 years into the speech Obama would give the next day, and I was happy with it. Usually, the night before a big speech, I'd sit on my balcony and read the words over to myself. Instead, I invited the team who had worked on Cuba with me, Ricardo, Bernadette, and Siobhan Shields, a young staffer on Cuba, to my room. For a couple of hours, we drank Havana Club rum, read the speech out loud to one another, and told stories of our endless talks with the Cubans. "Sometimes I think we underestimate how hard they are pushing inside this system," I said to Ricardo. I knew that even if the Cubans weren't making changes in exchange for candy, they had opened the door to America. Our travelers, our businesses, the giant neighbor to the north with our different ideology and way of doing things, and now our president. "Yeah," Ricardo said. "Hey, thanks for including me in this." A few months earlier, he'd left the NSC for a posting in Sao Paulo. Before leaving, he told me something that he never had before about his father. I knew he had been a Honduran military officer who ended up on the wrong end of an internal struggle and was eventually killed, which led to Ricardo's growing up in America and going to work for the State Department, because he saw America as a force for good in a chaotic world. But the story was more complicated. Even though he came from a right-wing family, Ricardo's father had become something of a reformer and whistleblower on corruption. He was pushed out of the military over his opposition to Honduran support for the Contra program, and he was killed by the type of reactionary forces who had battled Cuban proxies across Latin America, a victim of the poisoned politics that we had set out to bury. From my balcony, we looked out at the darkened Florida Straits that separated Cuba from the southern tip of America. Being there, in Havana, with this group of people who'd become like a second family, I felt better than I ever had before in my job. This is why you put up with everything. The speech took place at a grand theater that had been restored for the occasion. Raúl Castro sat in a balcony. The famous blind Cuban ballerina Alicia Alonso, for whom the theater is named, entered to thunderous applause. We'd fought hard to invite dozens of guests, including many Cuban Americans. Obama walked to the lectern and began with the words of Martí's most famous poem, "Cultivo una rosa blanca." From there, the speech broadened out to track both the story of 60 years and my own feelings working on Cuba for the last 3. "Havana is only 90 miles from Florida," Obama said. "But to get here, we had to travel a great distance, over barriers of history and ideology, barriers of pain and separation." Covering the period from the revolution to the missile crisis to today, Obama said, "I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people." The audience erupted in applause. It was too much for me. I slipped out a back door to a side street, smoking, staring at dilapidated facades and old cars, the empty street frozen in time outside a theater where history was happening. I knew the notes he was hitting, having nearly memorized the speech myself. The tributes that Cubans would appreciate to their education and healthcare systems, their stance against apartheid in South Africa. I knew the cultural touchstones that would unite people across the straits, the music and dances and athletes. I knew the language that would resonate to the North. In America, we have a clear monument to what the Cuban people can build. It's called Miami. I went back inside just as Obama was making the case for engagement. This is not just a policy of normalizing relations with the Cuban government, he said. The United States of America is normalizing relations with the Cuban people. And then came the careful balancing act, an extended tribute to Cuban small business owners, something that Cubans never heard from their own government. A call to end the embargo, which drew thunderous applause. But then the onus was put on the Cubans. But even if we lifted the embargo tomorrow, Cubans would not realize their potential without continued change here in Cuba. I had set up the language about democracy by acknowledging the past. Before 1959, Obama said, some Americans saw Cuba as something to exploit, ignored poverty, enabled corruption. And since 1959, we've been shadow boxers in this battle of geopolitics and personalities. I know the history, but I refuse to be trapped by it. It was the same thing I had said to Alejandro in our very first meeting. And then Obama said what he believed, that people should be equal under the law, that citizens should be free to criticize their government and protest peacefully, that voters should have the freedom to choose their government in open elections. I believe those human rights are universal, Obama said. I believe they are the rights of the American people, the Cuban people, and people around the world. The Americans in the audience applauded. Raul Castro sat in his seat with a thin smile. We were pushing, I knew, too far, too fast. But we were saying what we believed, and sometimes that is all that you can do. The speech ended on Obama's note about reconciliation between Cubans and Cuban Americans, drawing on stories I'd been told over the last few weeks. A woman meeting her sister for the first time in 60 years. Another woman who went back to her family's old home and was recognized by a neighbor she hadn't seen in decades. We can make this journey, Obama concluded, as friends and as neighbors and as family, together. Si se puede. The speech had said everything I believed and had stirred a pot. Every Cuban would hear it a different way. I had tried to paint a picture of a future in which there was a place for everyone's story, for the story of the revolution and the dignity of a Cuba that stood up to the United States, for the story of the dissidents who protested that government and the entrepreneurs building a new Cuban economy, for the story of the exiles who'd fled or been forced to flee to the United States, for the story of the nameless Cubans who didn't have a voice in the conflict between our countries, but simply wanted a better life. But that's what touched a nerve among hardliners. A sympathetic speech about the Cuban Revolution would have been easy to dismiss as an apology for tyranny in Miami. A boorish speech about democracy would have been easy to dismiss as imperialism in Havana. This was something different. Sure, a speech I wrote, but a speech that only Obama could give. I've never gotten more positive feedback on one of his speeches, but it also ended up provoking a rebuke from Fidel Castro and pushback from opponents of the rapprochement in both countries. Our final stop was the baseball game. I walked out into the sunshine of a baseball stadium with tens of thousands of cheering fans. I was seated next to Alejandro, who passed me his young daughter, just a year or two older than Ella. A few seats away from me, Obama was introducing Rachel Robinson to Raul Castro, while Derek Jeter looked on. And then the game began, my favorite sport, the one I'd played as a child in Central Park with my father, finding my own confidence in the ability to catch a ball and throw it back to him. For a few moments, politics disappeared. There was just a game on a sun-splashed field, and it was easy to feel that the future didn't belong to missile crises or ISIL attacks, ideological disputes or geopolitical competition, demagogues in Cuba, America, or any place else. I was just one person in a large crowd watching a game on a perfect afternoon, comforted by the sound of so many human beings responding to the direction of the ball in front of us, feeling that finally I could just relax in the midst of something that was real, that was true. Chapter 29. The Stories People Tell About You. Early one afternoon in February, I walked out of the entrance of the West Wing, climbed into the back seat of a black car, and was driven a single block to the underground parking garage of the new executive office building, a characterless government building across Lafayette Park, to appear before the House Select Committee on Benghazi. Every aspect of my and Susan Rice's appearance had been subject to a months-long negotiation. No White House likes to allow staff to appear before Congress because it wants to avoid setting a precedent by which staff who give advice to the president can be summarily hauled up to Capitol Hill. I just wanted to get the whole thing over with, but I was caught in the middle of powerful interests, Republicans who wanted to perpetuate their Benghazi show, a presidential campaign that had been shaped in part by the Select Committee's discovery that Hillary Clinton had used a private email server as Secretary of State, and a White House protecting the institution of the presidency. My own story, what had actually happened during the few days around the Benghazi attacks, seemed to have become irrelevant. To avoid the spectacle of Susan's and my going to the Hill amid a cluster of reporters, the White House counsel agreed to this alternative venue. Susan appeared in the morning, and I passed her in the parking garage as she left, making eye contact and saying very little. It was now 40 months since the Benghazi attacks. Ever since, we'd both been living as figures of controversy, convicted of a charge that neither of us understood. How had we hatched some kind of cover-up? And what exactly were we alleged to have covered up? At Susan's 50th birthday party, I'd kept my eyes on her aging mother, who had taken the villainizing of her daughter particularly hard as she stared at a slideshow of Susan's life that was playing on a loop, her eyes filled with tears that never seemed to fall. The meeting took place around a large table in a conference room with a handful of members of Congress and staff on one side. I sat flanked by White House lawyers and my own personal attorney. For the first few minutes, there were conversations back and forth about the agreed-upon process and parameters. I sat there silently, feeling more like a prop than a human being. The day before, I'd had a stomach flu, and I had two large Gatorades to sustain me. I spent the next 4 hours being questioned about the minutiae of my experience on the day of the attacks and the week after. Emails I had little memory of writing or receiving were placed in front of me. I had to be mindful that anything I said could be taken out of context and used to suggest a meaning I didn't intend. The questioning was split between staffers who seemed to have only a slight understanding of how government works and congressional representatives who enjoyed playing the role of prosecutor. It wasn't hard to navigate, as there was nothing for them to discover, no hidden truth that could justify the time, expense, and outrage that they had dedicated to this charade. The chief antagonist on the Republican side was the committee chairman, Trey Gowdy, a former assistant U.S. attorney whose small, beady eyes opened wide when he feigned incredulity, and whose stiff shock of gray hair looked like a Tyrolean hat. The absurdity of the exercise hit home for me about halfway through, when Gowdy grilled me about a printed-out email chain that was handed to me. "What is that subject line?" he asked. I read it aloud. "The U.S. public response to events in Libya and Egypt." On the list of recipients were many of the various people who worked on national security communications in September 2012. "In Libya and Egypt," he said, as if circling some essential truth. And the very first item discussed are talking points on what? I stared at the email, which included talking points about the internet video, the stock language we'd circulated so that people could condemn it while stressing that it didn't justify violence. The email chain was the kind of basic communications channel we always established so that we could share public talking points and draft Q&As. "Mr. Chairman," I said, "the subject line was originated on September 12th in reference to statements that the U.S. government was going to make in response to events in Libya and Egypt. The contents with respect to the movie were in an email I wrote the following day. Mr. Rhodes, I'm asking you who told you the movie was the catalyst for the attacks in Benghazi. Who told you that?" I looked at the email, trying to understand what he was getting at. I hadn't even written the subject line. "Again," I said, "I'm not suggesting that the movie is the catalyst for the attacks in Benghazi." "Well, can you see how a reader might think that maybe you were? Since the first country mentioned in the subject line is Libya? But the subject line was created the day before I wrote the content of my email regarding a different set of circumstances," I said. And that's when the cynicism of what he was doing hit home. We had started the email chain after the violence in Libya and Egypt and used it for days because the right people were on the distribution list, including people at the State Department who had to find the right words to answer questions and try to put out the fires burning across the region because of this offensive video. Gowdy was using the subject line to turn everything that followed into a conspiracy theory. To believe we'd done something wrong, you'd have to believe that we were all pretending to be concerned about the video all week, or that we were using something as innocuous as a subject line, the U.S. public response to events in Libya and Egypt, to signal some grand conspiracy theory to people working across the government. Gowdy isn't dumb. He had to know that wasn't the case. He was simply using whatever shred of language he could to keep his conspiracy theory alive, just as the Republican Party had been doing for the last 40 months. He stared at me evenly, as though I wasn't a real person whose own life and reputation had already been ravaged by this farce. The Republicans loved, especially, to point out that I'd received a master's degree in fiction when I was 24 years old, as if, like the subject line of an email, that fact confirmed I was a liar, an inventor of stories. "So, you never intended anyone to believe that the video was in any way connected with the attacks in Benghazi? Is that what you are testifying to?" I stared at him across the table, suppressing an urge to shout. Instead, I just said calmly, "I intended at every juncture to provide the best information I had from the intelligence community about what took place in Benghazi. I also had to try to mitigate the fallout from this video." "Those are two separate things," he said. I could have said, "No, Mr. Chairman, they weren't two separate things. This offensive video, probably fueled by the crass Islamophobia that characterized the right-wing's nativist response to the 9/11 attacks and Obama's election, lit a spark in the Middle East. It led people to attack our embassy in Cairo. People in Benghazi saw that happening and went to our facility to protest, to loot, to attack, to commit acts of terror, and 4 Americans were tragically killed. Violent protests burned for days in dozens of places. What we said all week, what Susan Rice said on those stupid Sunday shows, was what we believed at the time, what the intelligence community told us we could say, and was far closer to the truth of what actually happened than anything you, Trey Gowdy, and the Republican Party and Fox News and Breitbart and thousands of talk radio segments and Donald Trump have alleged in an effort to destroy people's careers and delegitimize Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Your entire theory rests upon knowing the motivations of every individual who showed up at our facility in Benghazi that night, on knowing that they weren't motivated by a video that coincidentally motivated other people to attack other U.S. facilities in other Muslim-majority countries at the same time, and on knowing that all of us in the White House and the State Department and the intelligence community decided to pretend to care about that video, which we were also being asked about all week because it was the dominant news story in the world, to cover up something. You have relentlessly politicized the terrible loss of four Americans and constructed your own pyramid of conspiracy theories to further pollute American discourse and polarize the American people, a dynamic that has led to Donald Trump's being the front-runner for the nomination of your party. But that would have been pointless. In that room, at that moment, I wasn't a human being. I was a character in a political drama, one in which truth was meaningless. I looked at Gowdy with an empty expression. He'd already fulfilled his mission long before I showed up in this conference room. I gave a much shorter answer. I was, I said, dealing with both those things. At the same time that we were negotiating the terms of my Benghazi appearance, a writer named David Samuels sent me an email. He wanted to write a profile of me for the New York Times Magazine and wanted to know if I would agree to some interviews and let him follow me around for a few days. I'd never dealt with Samuels before. He wasn't someone on the White House beat. A cursory Google search showed that he'd written for the type of magazines I liked to read, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Harper's. Underneath all that, there surely was a mix of vanity and approval-seeking as well. I'd spent 7 years in a basement office. I was proud of what I'd done over the last year, with the Cuba opening and the Iran deal. I was frustrated at being transformed into a one-dimensional right-wing villain. Maybe this could be different. I said yes. Over the holidays, I traveled to Hawaii with Obama. While I was there, I started to hear from people whom Samuels was interviewing about me. Samantha Power reached out to say she was slightly disturbed by her conversation. "He seems to really like you," she said, "but I'd be a little careful. I can't tell what his angle is." When I finally sat down with Samuels in January, I had no idea what to expect. He was an intense guy, wide-eyed, probing, with glasses and slightly unkempt brown hair. We spent an hour or two talking about my life without even reaching the point at which I went to work for Obama. He asked questions about my parents, my religious background, my 9/11 experience, what authors I liked to read. He was eccentric, and there was a cynical edge to some of his questions. But if anything, the conversation seemed to confirm my hopes. This guy was going to have a different perspective. He seemed actually interested in who I was. Over the next few weeks, I did a few more interviews and let him follow me around to some meetings and appearances. One afternoon in my office, we had a long conversation about the decline of the news media. I lamented the fact that so many news organizations had been forced to close their foreign bureaus, leaving it to young political reporters to cover foreign policy, which caused complex issues to be covered through the distorted prism of Washington's political reality show. I complained about a foreign policy establishment that couldn't shake the groupthink around military intervention in the Middle East that had gotten us into Iraq. As I spoke, he urged me on, often in vigorous agreement. I was enjoying the back and forth, letting myself get worked up, dispensing with the Washington tradition of distinguishing between being on the record and off the record as we went along, a practice that always felt a bit slippery, to me, anyway. I never could figure out his angle. He interviewed Favreau about speechwriting, Ricardo about Cuba. He asked to speak to some of the people I'd worked with on Burma and Iran. Each time, I heard similar things from the people he talked to. "Be careful. He's an unusual guy. Not sure what he's getting at." Favreau forwarded me a several-thousand-word email that Samuels had sent him in the middle of the night, filled with questions about narrative, storytelling, and the practice of political rhetoric. Something wasn't right. Then one day, I heard from a journalist I knew. "You're doing a profile with David Samuels?" he asked, as if I had lost my mind. Samuels had opposed the Iran deal, he said. His wife was the editor of Tablet magazine, the publication that had accused us of the worst kind of anti-Semitism at the height of the Iran debate the previous summer. It was now February. My interviews with Samuels were done, and he was writing the piece. It would be almost 3 months before the article came out. I spent that whole time with a knot in my stomach, sensing that I'd had a terrible lapse in judgment, that this wasn't going to turn out well. I just didn't know how bad it would be. One morning in early May, I woke up to find that the story had been posted online. Before Anne was awake, I slipped out to the couch and began reading it on my iPhone. Picture him as a young man standing on the waterfront in North Williamsburg at a polling site on September 11, 2001, which was Election Day in New York City. There I was, on the day that had changed everything for me, and I could remember the person I had once been before everything began. He interspersed personal observations with glimpses of me at work, where he cast me as much better at my job than I actually was. At a time when I felt I had little control of how our foreign policy was portrayed, he described me as a master of communications, deftly navigating a balkanized media and taking on the president's critics. He referred to the American foreign policy establishment as the Blob. According to Rhodes, the Blob includes Hillary Clinton, Robert Gates, and other Iraq War promoters from both parties who now whine incessantly about the collapse of the American security order in Europe and the Middle East. I remembered using the phrase "the Blob" with Samuels, trying to capture that sense of groupthink that always seemed to lead inexorably to more military intervention in the Middle East, to bomb something. I didn't know that I'd affix the label to Clinton. She was going to be the Democratic nominee for president, so I immediately braced for angry calls I'd get from her advisors, friends of mine like Jake Sullivan. Then I reached the part about the media. "All these newspapers used to have foreign bureaus," he said. "Now they don't. They call us to explain to them what's happening in Moscow and Cairo. Most of the outlets are reporting on world events from Washington. The average reporter we talk to is 27 years old, and their only reporting experience consists of being around political campaigns. That's a sea change. They literally know nothing." I remembered the conversation, the vigorous agreement we'd had over the effect of closing bureaus. I sounded mean, arrogant, and dismissive. I was 29 when I went to work on the Obama campaign. Many of the journalists who I had become friends with were around 27 when they went to work covering the campaign. I assumed it would be the worst thing in the story. But then came the section on Iran. The way in which most Americans have heard the story of the Iran deal presented, that the Obama administration began seriously engaging with Iranian officials in 2013 in order to take advantage of a new political reality in Iran, which came about because of elections that brought moderates to power in that country, was largely manufactured for the purpose of selling the deal. Even where the particulars of that story are true, the implications that readers and viewers are encouraged to take away from those particulars are often misleading or false. Obama's closest advisors always understood him to be eager to do a deal with Iran, as far back as 2012. This was far worse than anything I feared, and it was patently untrue. First, because we'd never concealed our interest in an Iran deal. It was the defining fight of the 2008 primary. Second, because we never had serious negotiations with Iran before the election of Rouhani. And third, because we hadn't sold the deal as dependent upon a new political reality in Iran. We'd sold it on how the deal prevented Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. I remembered Obama's first instructions to me after the deal was reached. "We don't want to let the critics muddy the nuclear issue with the other issues." That's exactly what Samuels was doing, the trap I'd walked into. By eliminating the fuss about Iran's nuclear program, the administration hoped to eliminate a source of structural tension between the two countries, which would create the space for America to disentangle itself from its established system of alliances with countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Israel, and Turkey. With one bold move, the administration would effectively begin the process of a large-scale disengagement from the Middle East. I felt that I was seeing stated more clearly what the deal's critics thought about our motives. But it was Samuels's view, his narrative, his story of the Iran deal. We were trying to avoid a war and a nuclear-armed Iran. Samuels had turned the deal into a massive realignment of American foreign policy, one that positioned the United States in some kind of partnership with Iran. "We created an echo chamber," he admitted, when I asked him to explain the onslaught of freshly minted experts cheerleading for the deal. They were saying things that validated what we had given them to say. It sounded diabolical, but all I was describing was the most routine aspect of communications work. Briefing people. Disseminating fact sheets. Hoping that others who share your view will make the same arguments as you in public. This was no different from what any White House communications official does to support the rollout of a new policy. Sitting there on my couch, I read the story over two or three times. It was a clever and, in places, intelligent piece of writing. It made me sound smart, powerful, and ahead of my time. It also made me sound dishonest, bitter, and cynical. It took multiple readings to see how Samuels had used my criticism of the media to set up what he'd written about Iran, suggesting a connection that I'd never drawn, that a media that knows nothing can be fooled into supporting the Iran deal. It also alluded to my own background as a fiction writer, suggesting that someone who told stories was primed for this dirty work. I went to the White House nervous, embarrassed to face my colleagues. I felt as if I had a new target affixed to me, a laser dot on my forehead. But on first read, most of the people I heard from thought that the article was great for me, and so I allowed myself to think that for most of the day. Then the backlash started to build. The rest of that week was a blur. I had, with my own words, managed to pick fights with some of the most powerful interests in Washington. The media, the foreign policy establishment, the organized Jewish community, opponents of Iran. It was a combustible mix, and it seemed to explode, releasing some pent-up anger about things that ran far deeper than my words in a profile piece. The media was sensitive to charges that it had become more trivial because that was true. The foreign policy establishment was tired of being blamed for Iraq. Opponents of the Iran deal who'd lost the 2015 fight saw an opportunity to win in a rematch framed on their terms. I'd made myself an easy mark. The pile-on was worse than anything I'd experienced. At one point, I went to the Washington Post homepage, and there were seven pieces about me, all negative. I scrolled through Twitter, and almost everyone in my feed was trashing me. Articles were written about the shallowness of the books on the shelves of my office, which Samuels had described. A line of attack emerged that I must have invented an anecdote I'd told Samuels about seeing an Arab man in tears on the subway on the day of 9/11. I heard a podcast in which a New York Times reporter dismissed my negotiations with Cuba as just a few meetings in Canada. I had now been fully erased and replaced with a different person, a liar, an egoist, an asshole. Samuels wrote me long emails expressing surprise at how things were spiraling, even offering to have me come up to Brooklyn to stay with him. But one of the strangest things in the eye of the storm is that I wasn't angry at him. He probably believed the things he wrote about Iran, even the ones I knew to be untrue. I was angry at myself. He had caught me at a moment when I was too high on myself, coming off the successes of 2015, and too embittered at the nature of the political and media world that I'd been at the center of for 7 years. When I dropped my daughter off at daycare and made small talk with the other parents, I wondered if they now saw me as some shady character. I scrambled to cling to pieces of a life that I felt drifting away from me. I wrote lengthy apologies to the groups of people with whom I'd had the most meaningful collaborations over the last year, the Jewish Democrats in the House, the outside groups who'd helped us advocate for the Iran deal, the Cuban-American community in Miami, who proved to be the most supportive. People at work rallied around me, as they had before. I heard from dozens of people I'd worked with over the years, which made me feel as if I was dying, if not dead. Susan hosted a surprise party for me, the second such gathering in a year. Obama was more muted. A few days after the story, he called me back to his private dining area behind the Oval Office. "Why were you so eager to talk about how the sausage gets made?" he asked, with a note of irritation. "You've got to be more careful. We've still got 9 more months. Most people told me it would pass, but that wasn't true. My involvement with one of the things I was proudest of, the Iran deal, was now permanently tainted. A label would forever be attached to me. Ben Rhodes, who boasted of creating an echo chamber to sell the Iran deal. The right-wing critics now had fresh meat for the balance of the Obama years and beyond. All the dots in their drawing of me had been connected. Fiction writer, leaker, liar, Benghazi, Iran deal. People tell you those things pass, but they don't. You live your life knowing that the story out there about who you are is different from the person you think you are and want to be. Chapter 30. The Stories We Tell. You know what that New York Times story got wrong? Obama was sitting opposite me in the Beast, staring down at his iPad. 3 weeks had passed, but the fire was still not out. We were in Vietnam, yet another trip, yet another piece of our effort to extend American influence in Asia and turn the page on the past. The motorcade was winding through the streets of Hanoi, and enormous crowds lined the streets, a powerful sight in a country where millions of people had been killed only 2 generations ago, something that lent a little perspective to my own predicament. "That Iran section?" I said. It made me nervous that he was bringing up the story at all. Susan shot a protective look my way. "No, forget about that," Obama said. "That's just a pimple on the ass of progress." He flipped the cover of his iPad closed. "The notion that there's something wrong with storytelling. I mean, that's our job, to tell a really good story about who we are." For a moment, we all just stared out the window at the crowds. "I'm reading a good book now," Obama said. "It reminds you the ability to tell stories about who we are is what makes us different from animals. We're just chimps without it." He described how all civilization, religion, nations were rooted in stories, which could be harnessed for good or bad. Obama's tendency to take the long view was getting even more pronounced in his last year in office. But in his own way, he was also telling me that everything was okay, that this was now just one more subject in our endless conversation about everything. "What's the book?" I asked, looking for something to grab onto. "It's called Sapiens. You should check it out." Perhaps sensing that this was sensitive terrain, he changed the subject. "Now, what's with this thing I'm doing tonight with Anthony Bourdain?" That night, we'd arranged for Obama to have dinner with Bourdain at a small local restaurant that wasn't getting advance notice, so it would be filled with whoever showed up there on a random weeknight. "He's the guy who wrote that book, right?" he asked. "Yeah, Kitchen Confidential." I explained to Obama about how much I'd come to like Bourdain's shows. "His philosophy isn't that different from yours. If people would just sit down and eat together and understand something about each other, maybe they could figure things out." "So we're doing this for you?" he laughed. At the restaurant that night, I sat with a small number of staff and Secret Service in a room adjacent to where Obama and Bourdain ate bowls of bún cha and spring rolls. I had headphones that allowed me to listen to their conversation. Sitting in this tiny room with colleagues who'd become close friends, sipping broth, beer, and noodles, thousands of miles from home, I felt a sense of peace. It was an apt metaphor for my experience of the presidency itself. Just off stage, eating the same things, hearing the words, but not the principal participant. When the meal was done, I met Bourdain. He looked a little shell-shocked, as if still trying to understand how his own life had led him to interview the President of the United States in this small noodle shop. I rushed through the story of my own experience with Laos, beginning with his show. "You should know," I said to him, "that later this year we're going to Laos, and I think we're going to be able to get $100 million to clean up UXO. He looked at me as if I was crazy, a bemused grin on his face. The helicopter took off for Hiroshima, the final stop on our trip. I was sitting next to Caroline Kennedy, our ambassador to Japan, who had politely but persistently insisted that we make this visit in calls, emails, and visits to the White House for many months. When Obama took office, no U.S. ambassador had even traveled to Hiroshima for the annual commemoration of the bomb dropping. Obama was going to break an enormous taboo in our relationship with Japan and our own history. He was going to become the first sitting president to visit Hiroshima. It would be a short stop where Obama would give a speech that he and I had been working on over the course of the trip, something that grappled with the enormity of dropping the atomic bomb. He had rewritten my first draft entirely in his small, careful handwriting, reflecting each of our strange moods in his last year in office. The speech had turned into a meditation on the meaning of war and whether it can be stopped. As we left behind a military hangar filled with U.S. troops, Obama returned to talking about the book he'd been reading, and I could tell that it was his way of indirectly addressing the discomfort of flying in a United States military helicopter to a city that the United States had once destroyed. "It's interesting," he said, "that individual human beings didn't benefit much from the agricultural revolution. Life was actually better for hunters and gatherers." Some of the people in the helicopter looked a little confused, but I knew that he'd rewritten the speech to pose questions about whether the march of technology would inexorably lead to the destruction of humankind. His tangent made a certain kind of sense. "Why?" I asked, knowing I had to keep this conversation going. "Because of feudalism?" "No," he said. "That was part of it. But it was also because for most of the early agricultural revolution, people focused on grain. Grain is not as nutritious and balanced as eating a diet with proteins, fruits, and nuts. Hunters and gatherers lived in small units, 10 to 12 people, and agriculture required people to have more children, which led to disease and infant mortality. Life actually got worse." He looked out the window at the blue water below. It was a gorgeous, sunny afternoon. "It's interesting. Most of human history is unrecorded. We were around for millions of years and don't know much about how people lived. Recorded history didn't begin until 8 or 9,000 years ago." Then he went on to talk about the Neanderthals and how they were more developed than was commonly believed relative to Homo sapiens. "Humans," he said, "just developed a slight advantage in terms of language and socialization. That allowed them to develop the capacity to overrun the Neanderthals, who lived in relatively small groups." "Like the opening scene in 2001, I said. Everyone laughed. I looked at Caroline, whose father was president during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the time we came the closest to nuclear destruction, and wondered what she was thinking. It was quiet for a moment. Then Obama said, "It's kind of eerie, flying into Hiroshima. Down below, fishermen worked with nets in the water." "What are they doing down there, Caroline?" "Oysters," she said. She then described the process of harvesting pearls. From up above, it looked like a peaceful way to make a living. Why did we pick Hiroshima? Obama asked. This came up in my research for the speech, I said. We decided fairly early to preserve Hiroshima from other bombing runs so that we could demonstrate the impact of the bomb on a city that was intact. We wanted to show the Japanese what we could do, Caroline added. People were so accustomed to the air raid sirens that they didn't go into the shelters when they heard them, I said, especially because there weren't many planes. They gave an all clear, Caroline said. I don't know if I'd second-guess Truman's decision to drop the bomb, Obama said, the only person in the helicopter who could put himself in Truman's shoes. But there's something about the way we did it. The helicopter landed, and I got into one of the support vans in the motorcade. As we turned out of the airport, there was an enormous mass of people, smiling and waving. It was an awesome sight. As the cars rolled by, I tried to make out individuals in the crowds. I fixed on one small boy holding a sign that said, "Welcome to Hiroshima." And in that moment, I felt the flash of responsibility, the fact that we'd killed thousands of boys just like him, even if the brutality of the Japanese Empire compelled it. Going from Hanoi to Saigon to Hiroshima on a single trip was something that I couldn't entirely get my mind around, as was the fact that in these places, we'd been greeted by some of the largest crowds of Obama's presidency. The whole scene put the unpleasantness of the last few weeks into some perspective, but it also fed a sense of anger at the story I was caught up in back in Washington. The notion that there is no room for complexity. Ho Chi Minh was a communist, not a nationalist. We could not have dropped the atomic bomb on something other than a large city. There are no Iranian moderates. It was as if simply recognizing complexities and context was tantamount to pulling a thread that could cause some American narrative to unravel. The faces of the people lining these streets told a different story. Surely what made America great to them was not the fact that we dropped the bomb. It was the ideal associated with who we were, the fact that we had a president who was willing to acknowledge difficult histories and show respect for different people. Our constant struggle to improve ourselves and our country while seeking guidance from the story of our founding values, that is what makes America great. When we got to the center of the city, thousands of people stretched back from the Peace Park, the site of Obama's speech, right near Ground Zero. My seat was directly in front of the podium, only a few feet from where Obama would be speaking. A young Japanese girl handed Obama a wreath, which he laid at the base of the memorial. Then he stepped up to the lectern to deliver his speech. I've never heard such a large crowd so quiet as he began. 71 years ago, on a bright, cloudless morning, death fell from the sky, and the world was changed. A flash of light and a wall of fire destroyed a city and demonstrated that mankind possessed the means to destroy itself. The weather was clear, and it was approaching the same time of year that we'd dropped the bomb, putting an end to a horrific war and cementing our status as a superpower. I looked at the buildings all around us. Every one of them had been built since that day. Artifacts tell us that violent conflict appeared with the very first man. Our early ancestors, having learned to make blades from flint and spears from wood, used these tools not just for hunting, but against their own kind. He was, I knew, grasping for the largest possible context in which to make sense of not just this historical event, but of a world that he'd interacted with as its most powerful inhabitant for nearly 8 years. The stubborn duality of humanity's capacity for ingenuity and its capacity to do harm. I had a hard time looking at Obama as he spoke. Normally, I'd be pacing somewhere backstage, watching the lines scroll on a teleprompter. My eyes kept being drawn toward the eternal flame and dome in the distance. I thought about his own constant struggle to constrain our own war-making, his fear at the height of the ISIL fever,